Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, featuring real-world case discussions and current questions and controversies in the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Catherine Coombs from UCI Health in Orange, California. To begin, I asked Dr. Coombs to review several interesting patient cases from her practice, starting with an elderly widow with dementia and newly diagnosed CLL who received initial treatment with zanubrutinib. So let's start out with your first patient here, this 82-year-old woman. And before we get into exactly what you decided to recommend to her and exactly what happened, can you just kind of paint a little bit of a picture of how she presented, you know, the first time you saw her?
So this patient actually first presented to medical attention prior to me seeing her, but I think it gives some pretty good insight into the course and ultimately what was decided for her treatment. So I'll go through the history, which is she actually was a widow that was living alone in the Midwest. She was widowed 30 years ago, living by herself, and her brother usually would check in with her via phone call, but hadn't heard from her, which was very atypical. She wasn't answering her phone. And so he lives in California and requested local police to kind of check in on her because of this lack of response. And so when they went to her place, they actually found her unresponsive and brought her in for evaluation at the local hospital. And so on presentation, she did have an elevated white count. It was not dramatically elevated. It was only 13.4, but she did have a lymphocytosis ALC of 11, and neutropenia that was mild, 1.9. But she was very severely anemic. Her hemoglobin was actually 3.8, and her platelets were also low at 85. So she underwent pretty extensive workup during this hospitalization, including a bunch of different labs to rule out causes of anemia. So her B12, folate, you know, LDH, haptoglobin, et cetera, were elevated. Ferritin was mildly elevated, suggested maybe of some type of chronic inflammatory picture, but otherwise nothing revealing. And there were no sources of bleeding, importantly. Her reticulocytes were actually a little on the low side, certainly inappropriate for her degree of anemia. Her peripheral smear showed some smudge cells, and then her peripheral flow was consistent with CLL. So they transfused her 3 units of red blood cells. Her hemoglobin did improve with this up to 9.3. And they did perform a bone marrow biopsy during this hospital stay, which I actually think was very important, just given kind of this unusual presentation. So I'll go into the results of the marrow. But, you know, after she was discharged from the hospital, her family did decide to move her over to California because it appeared that she was having some pretty significant memory issues that were, you know, still undiagnosed at this time. But ultimately, it does appear that she has dementia and wasn't able to care for herself. After arriving in California, and this is when I met her, she, following this flight, did appear to have some leg swelling and was found to have a DVT and a PE, that fortunately wasn't so severe, no oxygen requirement. The main symptom was leg swelling. So her other comorbidities are really just hypertension and hyperlipidemia, but now she's newly on apixaban. And her other con meds are hydrochlorothiazide, atorvastatin, and then potassium chloride. The social history, of course, is important in this case. So she's widowed, no children, but does have a couple siblings in California. And she's now living in an assisted living facility in California when I meet her.
So before you go on, I'm just kind of curious as you, you know, meet her and try to figure out what's going on with her. Was your sense that a lot of the morbidities and issues she was having were fairly new or maybe had slowly been developing? Do you think a lot of this was related to the disease process or maybe more chronic long-term? Did she have any significant clinical medical history?
You know, her medical history was pretty scant. She physically looks actually pretty fit when I see her. The clear issue is this dementia, which I think, you know, can go unnoticed for a long time to family members because it's appears pretty insidious in onset, especially in talking with her brother. But because she lived so far away, it was, I think, kind of hard for him to notice until it reached this kind of breaking point. So my perception is most of her issues, aside from the CLL, which I do believe it was the main cause for her anemia, I think we're very slowly progressive, but this is a woman who does not complain. She's very pleasantly demented. Every time I interact with her, she, you know, kind of minimizes any sort of symptoms or issues. Very sweet lady, but was someone who really needed someone to advocate for her and to have a closer eye on her to get the best care.
Interesting. Okay, let's hear a little bit about the workup.
Yeah, so I think the most critical part of the workup was the bone marrow biopsy, which I don't always do bone marrow biopsies in patients that I'm doing frontline treatment, especially if it's relatively obvious that the CLL is the cause. In her case, I think the bone marrow was pretty important because, number one, the anemia was so severe. But two, you know, her white count wasn't that high. And I think this is a good teaching point to trainees on why we don't really use the white count to determine whether someone does or doesn't need treatment, because it's not a great correlation for the degree of bone marrow infiltration. And so number one, I've seen patients with very high white counts that have perfectly adequate hematopoiesis and therefore don't need treatment because the patients are asymptomatic. And then the complete opposite, which is here, a very minimally elevated white count, but with very heavy involvement of the marrow. So again, her presenting white count was 13, but when we took a look at her bone marrow, she had very heavy marrow infiltration by the CLL. And so the marrow was about 95% cellular in this 80-something-year-old woman with about 90% involvement by the CLL. So it... with the rest of the workup for the anemia being negative, my conclusion is that this was something that was very slowly progressive that had gone unnoticed in the setting of this woman who, you know, was unable to advocate for herself and her progressive fatigue. her prognostic tests showed a few findings. Her FISH actually showed 13q deletion, which in and of itself would be a favorable marker. But the favorable aspect of the 13q is when it's an isolated abnormality. Her karyotype shows us she actually has some less favorable findings. Specifically, she had a complex karyotype with three different abnormalities. Her IGHV testing technically put her in the mutated category because it was more than 2% mutated, but she actually had the 321 family. And so this is a specific subset that's seen in CLL that's more commonly mutated, but it actually tracks with unmutated outcomes. So it's called the subset 2. So it's, you know, mutated, which normally is favorable, but unfavorable in her case because of the subset. Molecular testing, she didn't have any sort of TP53 mutations or other mutations on kind of the broader gene panel that was sent. But she did have an elevated beta 2 microglobulin of 4.
So just kind of curious how you viewed her risk status with the karyotypic abnormalities there. How did you view this? Because she's TP53 negative.
Yeah, so TP53 tells, I'd say, a lot of the story. I think the highest risk patients are still those with TP53 mutations or 17p deletion. However, complex karyotype has actually shown independent adverse prognostic risk. So I still do view her as a high-risk patient. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why I ultimately selected the therapy that I did for her.
Yeah, I want to get into your thinking. And in the first part of this discussion, I want to get an update on where we stand today with first-line therapy of CLL, particularly some of the things that have happened over the last couple of months, particularly at the ASH meeting. But again, before we sort of get more into her case and, you know, how you thought it through and discussed it with her, can you kind of summarize, you know, where we've been coming from the last year or so in terms of first-line therapy? And from your perspective, what you thought about what happened at ASH?
Yeah. So, I mean, ASH was, I'd say, the most exciting ASH in a long time for a CLL doctor. We had two phase three studies that were positive. And so as far as how those informed frontline therapy, I'll get into that. That was largely the findings of the AMPLIFY trial, which I wouldn't necessarily think about for this patient. But one of my later cases, I think it, you know, certainly could be practice changing for patients that I think are candidate for time-limited therapy with BTKI, BCL2 plus minus Oben. So the way I think about CLL in the current times is pending the FDA approval based on the AMPLIFY trial, which we'll get into. I think of two common standards of care. One is the use of a continuous BTK inhibitor, either zanubrutinib or acalabrutinib, or time-limited therapy with venetoclax and obinutuzumab. I think these are both highly effective therapies. I think there are very few patients that I see an absolute contraindication to. So most of the time I am discussing both of these standards of care with my patients. In the case of this patient, I actually think venetoclax and obinutuzumab could have been used. However, I did actually review that with her, but I think because of the logistical concerns and because of her age, it was just less appealing to be on a time-limited therapy. And so then that gets us to our treat-to-progression type therapies with zanubrutinib or acalabrutinib. And so the update from ASH was we saw the five-year update for the Sequoia trial, which is the use of zanubrutinib as a continuous monotherapy. The Sequoia trial compared zanu to bendamustine rituximab as the randomized portion of that trial. There were also kind of these cohorts that looked at 17p only, but not relevant to her case as she was non-17p TP53. And what we see with the five-year update of Sequoia is really excellent outcomes with respect to progression-free survival for patients treated with continuous zanu monotherapy. In my own hands, I use a lot of zanubrutinib. I've found it to be very well tolerated by most patients. And so I think it was a great therapy for this patient who desired a simple treatment. And, you know, with her dementia, I think the other added benefit is that it can be dosed once a day. She was living in an assisted living facility, but she was administering her own medicines. And she was still able to do that, though her brother, you know, was able to check on her frequently since they now live close by. And it, you know, would afford her hopefully disease control for, you know, potentially the rest of her life. Obviously, no one knows how much longer she'll live. But I think it offered, you know, all of those benefits.
I want to hear more about your thoughts in terms of choice of BTK, but first, just in general, how did you factor in and how do you think through the issue of her DVT and anticoagulation?
Yeah, so that was a big item of discussion, and that's why I actually did consider Venobin in her case. But when I talk through the logistics of that regimen, which are very time intensive for the first 8 weeks, it seemed, you know, pretty overwhelming, I think, to the patient and her brother, who, you know, largely is serving as her caregiver. But, you know, I'd say the reason to think about Venobin is it doesn't have this risk of bleeding. I think anticoagulation is not a contraindication, though, to using BTK inhibitor. The contraindication would be is if she was on warfarin, but she was not. And so we did spend a good amount of time talking about the bleeding risk. This is a woman who did not have any suggestion of past bleeding events. And fortunately, she was very stable. Now, if someone had frequent falls and needed an anticoagulation, I think that would give me more pause. But, you know, no history of bleeds, no history of falls, very steady on her feet. I reviewed the risk of bleeding, but I did not see the apixaban as a contraindication, but it was something that I educated her about.
I would like to hear your take on the AMPLIFY data and what you think it means in terms of clinical practice. But I also want to bring up another sort of weird thought I had, like right after ASH. We were doing a program where we do these programs where we have people present cases from practice, and a doc was presenting a case of a patient who actually started out with acalabrutinib and was responding, doing well. I think the patient had been on for about a month, and it occurred to me, like, if you could, would you consider in a patient who got started on acalabrutinib or maybe even zanu, I don't know, seeing how they do, and then maybe bringing in AMPLIFY. Any thoughts about whether or not people or you might think about that kind of strategy, start now with BTK, sort of see how people do like this and maybe go to an Amplify strategy if you could?
Yeah, that actually is something I have thought about. I have another older woman who I chose a Cala for because she has very difficult to control hypertension. And she was a little bit concerned about the risk of hypertension with Xanu. So we started her on a Cala monotherapy because she, you know, was overwhelmed a bit also by the Ven-Oben idea and the frequent visits and transportation. But she's had some toxicity with a Cala more than the usual patient. In general, I find a Cala very well tolerated. So I actually did offer to add in venetoclax in her case because, you know, tolerating a year of side effects is a lot more palatable than tolerating, you know, 7, 8, 9 years for, you know, what you would usually consider. Fortunately, in her case, she actually, all of her toxicities have gotten a lot better. So she actually had the classic Acala headache the first month or two. It got a lot better, number one, with the caffeine, which, believe it or not, it really is a good benefit to, especially in her case. But two, the headaches have actually subsided, and some of the other toxicities that started at the beginning have now subsided. And so she was not in favor of adding the Ven, but I was really thinking about it, you know, with those early toxicities as a way to kind of convert a treat to progression plan to a time limited plan.
Incidentally, mentioning the caffeine, because we brought this up a million times, people always bring it up, but recently somebody brought up something I hadn't thought about, like oral caffeine instead of coffee. You know, a lot of these cold, you know, pills for cold have decongestant, but they have Tylenol with caffeine in it. Have you ever, you know, had a patient use that, and does it help with the headaches or more just coffee?
Oh, I would think that the pills would work, but weirdly, I've not done that because I'm a coffee lover. So I just say, hey, if you like coffee, drink some coffee. But no, I should think about pills for people who don't like actually drinking coffee. I'm just not one of them.
Getting back to this issue, which has been, of course, a subject of great discussion for the last couple of years of, you know, which BTK. It's interesting that you seem to favor zanubrutinib. So first, before we get into sort of tolerability issues and comorbidities, is it your sense that indirectly compared, do you have the feeling that Xanu might be more effective?
That's a hard question to ask. And I'll be honest that I'm not a big fan of these indirect comparisons. In the end, you just have two great drugs and you just have to pick one of them. When it comes down to the brass tacks. So I have been tending to pick Xanu more. I've had a very good experience with both drugs. I will say I still use Acala, and in one of my later cases, and I already gave you another case, I tend to favor Acala in people with like difficult to treat hypertension because I still believe it's probably the best drug for hypertension. And that's just extrapolating, you know, somewhat where Acala had so much lower hypertension than ibrutinib, Xanu had similar hypertension to ibrutinib in the, you know, properly done head-to-head trials. That being said, is I don't have qualms about using Xanu in people with kind of what I would say is run-of-the-mill hypertension, like this woman who was just on one agent, no issues with difficult to control. And in the times I've used Xanu, I've not seen bad hypertension, but the trial data still suggests the actual percent of patients that get hypertension similar. So that's the drug I pick. I can't say it's better than Acala. I don't think we've had a study that has definitively shown that, but I think it's a very good drug. And in this patient specifically, I think it had the added advantage of simplicity where she doesn't need to remember to take that second dose.
You know, it's really amazing. I mean, we've done so many CME programs on CLL, and I still hear things that I haven't heard or things to talk about that I never thought about in terms of that. What about in terms of one of the things I heard recently, I don't know if I'm the last person to hear this or not, is that, quote, persistent uncontrolled hypertension can lead to atrial fibrillation. And I was wondering, is it possible that the hypertension is in some way predisposing the AFib that you see with BTK inhibitors? Have you ever heard that discussed or ever thought about it?
I've definitely thought about that. And I think back in the ibrutinib days, a lot of us believe that. And I'll tell you, I'm not a whiz with cardiology, but I do think we saw somewhat of an uncoupling of the hypertension and AFib association when we've seen the now mature Elevate RR data. So, you know, maybe that can happen in some patients, but Elevate RR really showed me that I think the risk of AFib is somewhat independent of the risk of hypertension, because ibrutinib, high hypertension, high AFib, Acala, low hypertension, low AFib. But then, you know, to kind of add on to the whole story, Alpine, I think, is probably the best argument to make my case. Zanu, high hypertension, but still very low AFib. So I don't know, but I mean, hypertension is not good, but it's not the worst side effect most of the time. And I think the hypertension that occurs with Zanu is probably not as truly severe. So even though the incidence is similar, they, you know, have done this sub-analysis of the Alpine trial where the systolics don't go as high. And I've just not seen it be the same level of problem as I've seen it be with ibrutinib. Now, some of that may be that I've not had patients on Zanu for 4 or 5 years the way that I have with ibrutinib. It's not been around as long. I think the story is complex.
Any other comorbidities that would sway you one way or the other towards Zanu or Acala? Like, for example, a history of headaches or migraines that swing you away from Acala? Any other comorbidities that push you one way versus the other?
Yeah, I think the headache thing is a no-brainer to pick zanubrutinib. Other than that, nothing major comes to mind for me, because I think the drugs, toxicity-wise, are otherwise much more similar than different, other than the headache issue and then this, you know, potential hypertension difference.
So again, we're kind of talking, I guess, pre-ASH. I don't know if ASH was as historic as I think it was, but it seemed like it was. And we've been talking about combinations for so long, it seems like maybe it's here, but you can tell me. But before you do, one other issue about sort of the pre-ASH landscape is the issue of adding in anti-CD20. You know, with the Acala study, they saw greater benefit when the patients had obinutuzumab added. What's your thought about that? Do you ever add anti-CD20 to BTK?
I have, but it's pretty infrequent. And so it's not that I don't believe the data. I actually think the difference is so impressive with the long-term 6-year follow-up that I do believe it's a real benefit. And of course, technically speaking, the arms weren't like powered statistically for that comparison, but I believe it. That it is of benefit. I think it mostly comes down to the logistics and patient preference, where the patients that I'm discussing a BTKI as a continuous monotherapy are selecting that for the simplicity and the desire to avoid the infusion time. And so most of the time I don't, but I don't think it's unreasonable. The times that I have added it is I've definitely had a couple patients where I thought either there was a very obvious autoimmune cytopenia, or I had a suspicion that there may be an added level of autoimmune cytopenia contributing to cytopenias, whether it's, you know, anemia, I've had thrombocytopenia much more severe than the anemia, or vice versa. Usually you would see the Coombs positivity if it was an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, but not always. and then the second scenario is I've had one patient where he had such severe bone marrow involvement. I do think adding the obin can help for a bit more rapid of a response. So I've done that once in that case. And then the third scenario is patients who, for whatever reason, you know, the venetoclax obin is not appealing, but they're still very open to getting that added benefit and progression-free survival, to where then I add the obin. And so the one patient I can remember was very young. I think he was like in his 40s, but he was not able to get the time off work to do the entire ven ramp up, but, you know, kind of taking obin once a month was more palatable and he thought he could do that. And then, you know, the other patient I might think about is a patient where it's very appealing to use a BTK inhibitor because of perhaps bulky lymphadenopathy, but, you know, young enough to where the added obin is reasonable. You know, the other scenario where BTKs are appealing is TP53 mutation, but that's the subset where I'd say my enthusiasm for adding the obin is less, because on the subset analysis, there's no added benefit of the CD20. I think if there's some other reason to do it, such as an autoimmune cytopenia, or maybe, you know, you're desiring a more rapid response because of some clinical parameter, it's not inappropriate. But, you know, sadly, the highest risk patients don't, you know, seem to get an added benefit with respect to PFS. So that's not a reason I would automatically think about it. But the great, great majority of cases, I'm using BTKI as a monotherapy.
So let's find out what happened with this patient. Can you kind of talk about what happened once she got treated?
Yeah, so we started, and in her case, I did the daily dosing. I actually usually discuss the option with both patients, and I tend to use the once a day dose for patients who are not already on something twice a day. I just think it's easier as long as they don't have an aversion to the pill burden, which, you know, it is four pills. I do hear that'll change later in the year. They're changing the formulation. Okay, so she did the once a day, 320 daily. Her labs, when she started, her hemoglobin was around 8.5. She did have a little bit of redistribution lymphocytosis. So her white count started at 10, went up to 37. Her anemia initially actually got worse and her MCV was high. And so actually I checked her B12 and it was low, which is a little odd. It was actually normal before. And so then she kind of, you know, said, oh, I remember having a low B12. And so I put her on oral supplementation. And it actually did get better, but she did need one unit of red cells kind of in the interim because of this, you know, kind of strange transient B12 deficiency. But after that, her white count kind of gradually came down, and then the hemoglobin did start to improve. And so after being on this therapy for about 3 months, now her hemoglobin's close to 10. After being on it for about 4 months, close to 11. Her platelets haven't improved dramatically, but they started off, I think, around the 50 to 60 range. And at the most recent visit, they're about 80, and her hemoglobin was up to 11. She did have an episode of back pain that they asked, could this be the zanubrutinib? And so I'm usually not opposed to doing a dose reduction. This was something that was actually kind of suggested by her brother. And in the end, I said, hey, look, I'm okay with the dose reduction while we work up this back pain. But I did tell them my perception is, you know, most of the time the arthralgias and myalgias we see are, you know, not localized. I did an MRI, which was found to have a compression fracture. So I actually think her back pain was more likely due to that. You know, we did reduce her dose for that. And because all of her labs are okay, and she's, you know, somewhat frail and elderly, we so far have kept her on the same low dose, even though I do think it's an unrelated AE.
Just kind of curious, you know, how she appears when she walks into your clinic nowadays compared to before she started the zanubrutinib. How is she functioning? And particularly, what's her mentation like? Is it the same or any better?
The mentation is the same. And so I've multiple times brought up a neurology consult. I've even put the consult in. She has not gone to see neurology, but she has some type of underlying dementia. And I've told her brother, you know, I'm no dementia expert, but, you know, you should see a neurologist. I think it's not a huge priority for them at this point, but just to get the workup and see, you know, if there's any type of treatment for the dementia, you know, whether it's Alzheimer's or vascular dementia, something else. But that has not changed. She's still very pleasantly demented. She is someone who does not complain hardly at all. So most of the complaints, including this back pain, came through her brother. I would say she looks more physically vigorous. Less pale. So there have been some physical changes, I think, that I can appreciate related to her anemia improving, but no change in the dementia.
I was thinking, really, you know, the persistence of the brother to get the police out there and all probably saved her life. I wonder if she even would have survived if that hadn't happened.
No question. Thankfully. Yeah, I think, yeah.
Great case. All right, let's get into the second case. Now we're talking about a 49-year-old patient. What happened with this man?
Yeah, so the cases actually are either very old or very young. So this is one of my young patients. And, you know, I do see some young patients. This is a 49-year-old man, came in, as many CLL patients do, asymptomatic lymphocytosis. So this is obviously a more common scenario. A very fit guy. He's had a little bit of low back pain, but it's been worked up. Unremarkable MRI, is pretty physically active. He just takes occasional ibuprofen for his back pain. Married with two young kids, high school teacher, physically active, loves hiking, exercising. So his labs, his white count was about 41. His ALC was 35, but normal hemoglobin at 14, normal platelets at 160. And he had a really unremarkable physical exam. I did not do a marrow in his case. His flow cytometry was consistent with CLL. And so I just sent his peripheral blood testing for his prognostic markers. So he had a 13q deletion and then this IgH deletion just in a small subset of his cells on FISH testing. The karyotype only showed the 13q deletion, though. No TP53 mutations, but he was found to have an unmutated IgHV. So, you know, he does have this one high-risk marker. And I just had him on watch and wait. I actually wanted to put him onto the early intervention trial of early Venobin versus delayed Venobin, but his CLL IPI score was not high enough risk to be eligible for that trial. So we did watch and wait.
So before we go on, can you just provide a brief update on where we are in treating asymptomatic high risk? I know there have been trials ongoing and also reported. What's the bottom line of what we've learned to this point?
Yeah, the bottom line is there's currently no role for early intervention outside of a clinical trial. The most modern trial that's been reported is the CLL12 study. It was ibrutinib versus placebo. And they had a bit broader of a risk of the patients that were eligible. And so they focused on higher risk patients. But I think when you look at their definition of high risk, a lot more patients would have been eligible for that than the current ongoing study where they focus on high to very high risk by the CLL IPI or patients with complex karyotype, which is a small subset. So with that trial, there's no overall survival benefit of early intervention with ibrutinib, and it just, you know, adds kind of classic ibrutinib side effects. So I do not recommend early intervention unless it's on a trial. And I really do love the trial design for the ongoing cooperative group study led by Dr. Debbie Stevens, run through the SWOG group, but open, you know, of course, all across the United States. So they're focusing on very high risk, which is either, as I mentioned, high or very high by CLL IPI or complex karyotype. And so that only accounts for maybe about a third of the usual watch and wait patients. And patients get randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to early intervention with Venobin. So they get treated kind of once they complete their screening and are randomized to delayed Venobin, which is what we would do anyway, meaning treat once someone's, you know, sick enough by the IWCLL standard criteria for starting treatment. No results from this trial. This is going to take a while to read out. The primary endpoint, very appropriately in my view, is overall survival. I think that is the bar that we should be using for treatment with early intervention, because there's a lot of harm to be done, you know, to asymptomatic patients. And so you really want to prove a substantial clinical benefit, which OS, in my view, is the right endpoint.
So it looks like this patient started to have progression. What happened?
Yeah, so it over the coming year, I was seeing him about every 3 months, not someone who complains much, but at the most recent visit, he did say, hey, I'm having some left upper quadrant pain, and his white count had been coming up. So his white count is now up to 87, mostly lymphocytes, and he has a mild anemia now. His hemoglobin was 10.4 and his platelets were 87, and his spleen was actually pretty impressively large. It was 7 centimeters below his costal margin. So I did do imaging. He didn't have symptoms that made me worry about a Richter's transformation, you know, no sort of B symptoms. And he didn't have obvious lymph nodes on exam. But on his CT scan, he did have a couple areas of lymphadenopathy. The biggest lymph node was 4 centimeters, and then this large spleen was seen. So I, of course, do think he does need therapy now. And so with how young he is, it is very appealing to think about a time-limited regimen. So I did discuss the use of a continuous BTKI, but spent a lot of time talking to him about what I view as the main standard of care, venetoclax and obinutuzumab. And so that's what he has now started just a few months ago. However, you know, with the readout of the AMPLIFY trial, I do actually think this might be a patient where the A plus V regimen might be appropriate. And though I don't think I'd add obin for most patients, I actually think in this patient, I might have had, you know, this been an option, the triplet.
How did he do with the obinutuzumab?
You know, everyone has infusion reactions. I don't think I've ever seen anyone that hasn't, especially when they have an elevated white count. And this is when they get open as their first therapy. I've certainly had a much easier time, you know, using it after patients have been debulked. I learned a trick from a colleague. So, you know, the package insert for open is 25 an hour for 4 hours. everyone has a problem with this 25. And so what I had been doing is 3 days of prednisone before, 50 milligrams. I don't know if that helps, but I do that. And still everyone was reacting. And so after kind of talking with, you know, a lot of colleagues on what they do, a CLL friend of mine told me, hey, just start the infusion at a slower rate. It adds about an hour, you know, hour and a half of infusion chair time. But in his experience, that it helped. And so I've been doing this for the past maybe 6 to 8 months. And I think it does help. And so the pearl and trick that I would recommend if you have the infusion chair capability is, and I actually think it may end up saving time, is start at 6, ramp up to 12, and then just cap out at 24 for the day. And I do think that lessens the reaction. So people do still react, but I do think it's better than just starting at 25. I think the 25 may be too much for most people. So he of course did react, but luckily it was nothing completely terrible. I think Rigers and a drop in blood pressure. But I think the amount of time that we had to stop the infusion was pretty minimal, and he got through the day. And then almost everyone does fine day two in my experience. So it's just something I always prep people for. I always tell them to bring a driver because, you know, usually when people react, we have to give them kind of IV Benadryl and, you know, some extra steroids, et cetera. So it's just better to have a driver the first couple days. But yeah, otherwise he's done totally fine so far.
That's really a great pearl in terms of the infusion there. I'm going to try to pass that along. And I can see that maybe lowering the blood pressure of the infusion nurses because this is not kind of a stressful time when they get this full-blown, I've heard it called shakes and bakes. But anyhow, I'm glad he did well. Again, can you talk about what the Amplified trial looked at, the three arms of the trial, what they saw, and what your take was?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Amplify trial was an international study. The standard of care regimen was chemoimmunotherapy, which was either FCR or BR. The experimental regimens, of course, are the ones that are more interesting now that chemo is kind of, you know, not something I'm using at all for actually quite a while now. And one regimen was Acala plus Ven. The other was Acala plus Ven plus Oben. And so it's a 2 month Acala lead in, and then the Ven gets ramped up. And so it ends up being 14 months total. The Oben is 6 cycles, and it's just kind of the standard way that we do the obinutuzumab. So the patients were randomized 1:1:1. Importantly, they did exclude 17P from this trial, which is good because it'd be, I'd say, pretty unethical to allow them to get FCR, BR. And the primary endpoint was PFS. And so they powered to compare A plus V to the chemoimmunotherapy and AVO to the chemoimmunotherapy. Technically, it's not powered to compare AV versus AVO, but of course, we're all going to look and see how those arms kind of stacked up against each other with that limitation.
So can you talk about what they saw?
Yeah, absolutely. So we saw the first readout from this trial at ASH as an oral presentation. Very exciting because this may lead to a registrational approval. So I think it was no surprise to me that the Acala plus Ven arms were superior with respect to PFS to the chemoimmunotherapy arm. I think the interesting findings were, number one, the AVO did outperform AV. From a numerical standpoint, again, you have to be careful because it wasn't powered statistically. So a pretty decent difference between the 36-month PFS between AV and AVO, which were both better than the FCR-BR arm. So it's like 76% for AV, 83% for AVO, and then chemo 66% at that 3-year mark. So the follow-up is still pretty immature with respect to, you know, this being a frontline study. We want to see longer-term follow-up, but both the Calaven arms were superior. The interesting thing to me, though, is I think comes with the survival story. So the AVO was a lot more efficacious, but it was at a cost, which was the toxicity cost. So the toxicity, I think, comes with the OS results and the COVID deaths. And so just keep in mind, the study accrued, I think, between 2019 to 2021. And so a lot of patients were on active treatment during kind of the really tough times of the early COVID pandemic. So looking at just the OS analysis as a whole, AV was superior to chemoimmunotherapy. AVO was not. And I the discrepancy was related to the COVID deaths. So there were very few COVID deaths with the AV arm, but there were 20-some COVID deaths in the AVO arm, and there were 20-some COVID deaths in the chemoimmunotherapy arm. And so I'd say that's my big reservation with using AVO. And so, you know, kind of expectedly, they did a COVID censoring analysis for patients, you know, let's take away the COVID deaths. And then AVO, of course, now looks a lot better. But, you know, I think that's an interesting analysis, but it doesn't take away my concern with respect to toxicity completely, because if someone's not dying from COVID, how do we know he or she is not dying from some other infectious complication? I think the CD20 really does add a lot in the way of immunosuppressive toxicity, in addition to some cytopenia increase. The other interesting story with respect to efficacy that I also want to mention is the AV, I would say, led to lower rates of MRD than what I was hoping for. And so I think prior to this study, you know, we haven't seen really much in the way of data with AV as a doublet. The rates of undetectable MRD, I thought, would be similar to ibrutinib plus ven, and they actually were probably quite a bit lower. So we saw very high rates of undetectable MRD with the AVO arm, which is great. And we've also seen data related to that from a phase 2 trial led by Dr. Matt Davids at Dana-Farber. But the AV rates of MRD were pretty low. I think they were right around 30-some percent. And that's lower than what we've seen in the I plus V studies. And so, you know, a lot of people have kind of surmised, oh, maybe this is because there's this pharmacologic interaction where ibrutinib actually drives up the level of venetoclax. I also think maybe ibrutinib's a little more potent than acala. I still think acala is the better drug because, you know, you have to look at the whole picture. You know, it's much better tolerated. But yeah, I'd say I was disappointed by the low rates of MRD, but I don't think that would be a reason for me not to use AV, because again, I still think PFS is most important. I think AV is still much more convenient than VO. So I think I would use AV for patients maybe that are borderline for VO, kind of want something time limited, but don't want the frequent appointments. But then there's, you know, the patient, like the patient in my case, who's super young, very fit, and really is desiring a deep response because of his young age. And because also I think he's someone who could withstand the potential for toxicity. Maybe that's someone I would think more about AVO.
So I guess one of the issues there is there were not two other arms in the Amplify trial. There wasn't another arm that had just BTK alone, and there wasn't another arm that had just venobin alone. So we're kind of left with indirect comparisons. From your point of view, how does the efficacy of AV indirectly compare to the two standard options we're using nowadays?
Well, I've looked at this, but I just want to give a big caveat that this was a very different patient population and a very different time. But I think the best study to indirectly compare to is the CLL13 trial, where it was different ven-containing regimens to the same standard of care, FCR-BR, and these patients also could not have 17P. And look, ven-O looked better in that study than AV, but you didn't have this COVID dropout effect. So I don't know if it's better or not. And, you know, we did not get the trial that I think we all wanted, which is AV versus VO. Fortunately, we will get that trial sort of whenever the MAGIC trial reads out. But I say sort of because, you know, the MAGIC trial is AV versus VO, but they have this MRD, you know, guided duration of treatment where patients can actually prolong therapy if they're not MRD negative after a year. And so it's technically not exactly comparing fixed duration AV versus VO. But yeah, I'd say it's a little worse than, you know, what I would have thought Ven-O would do, but at a mostly different time. I think the patients are somewhat similar, but, you know, the accrual period different, the geographic, differences, et cetera, kind of make it a tough indirect comparison for me.
What do we know about Zanu of venetoclax? And for docs who are used to using Zanu, if they could, would it be a reasonable consideration to do Amplify with Zanu? So in other words, Zanu, venetoclax, or is that too much of a leap from the Amplify trial?
I don't think it's a crazy leap, but I wouldn't leap it from the Amplify trial. I'd leap it from the Sequoia trial, where there actually was a cohort using Zanu and Ven. So we saw a a longer term readout from that at EHA last year in Madrid. So yeah, there are data for Zanuven. It wasn't a huge study. Don't quote me, but maybe around 80 patients. It was 17P that we saw. So that cohort got enriched for 17P, and the data we saw, I believe, was all 17P, but they later allowed non-17P patients in. So there are data for Zanuven. It's highly efficacious, but the kind of weird thing about that trial, for whatever it's worth, is they required a lot more time on the doublet. So I think it was a minimum of either 24 or 27 cycles. And the data we saw was, I think the median follow-up was like, I don't know, like 30 months. So the efficacy looks amazing. But the caveat, I would say, is that most of these people were still on therapy. So, you know, I don't think it's a crazy leap, but it's probably not something I would do. The doublet that I think I probably would use in practice is Zanu and Sonrotoclax, but that's pending the readout of a phase 3 trial, the Celestial study, that's going to take a while to read out. So Sonrotoclax, of course, is not yet FDA approved, but that's the design of the study that should lead to a registrational approval.
Is sonrotoclax any different from what you can tell than venetoclax in terms of efficacy, TLS, et cetera, et cetera?
I don't know. As far as what I've seen, what I will say is the clinical data look great, and so do the preclinical data. But I think we just need more mature follow up on it. But you know, it's kind of our newer generation venetoclax. Supposedly, it's like 10 times more potent in the preclinical studies. So it's kind of the stronger son, I suppose. And it may have activity even in the setting of some of these, in the setting of the most common venetoclax resistance mutation, which is G101V, something like that. But nonetheless, most of the time it's being studied in ven-naive patients. And the early phase data look excellent. It's kind of one of the comical PFS curves that you see at CLL conferences where it's like literally just a straight line. So it's 100% response rate in combination with Zanu, no progressions. And they've studied it both in the frontline and relapsed refractory setting. The limitation to all the data is it's really short follow-up. But, you know, we have a phase 3 trial that, you know, is hoping to prove superiority to Ven-Oben. So it's Zanus and Roto versus Ven-Oben standard of care. And I think that could be really practice changing if that's a positive study.
Let's hear about your third case, a 76-year-old man. Maybe you can sort of capsulize what happened and kind of get to the thing I really want to ask you about. Is this is a patient who got pirtobrutinib. So kind of what happened that led up to him getting pirtobrutinib?
Yeah, so this man was referred to me in the setting of heavily relapsed disease. So he's 76, but he's had CLL for 15 years. So he was diagnosed in 2010, had a lot of treatments prior to me meeting him. So he actually got kind of a suboptimal therapy in 2011, rituximab monotherapy, relapsed, you know, as expected, relatively quickly in 2 years later, and got Benda rituximab in 2013, which is very reasonable then. Followed by maintenance rituximab. Then he recurred about 4 years after that, but it was not a quick recurrence. He was put on ibrutinib, though, the following year, 420 daily. Did fine with this as far as side effects, but did progress about 3 years later. Appropriately got the Murano regimen in mid-2021 of venetoclax and rituximab. He did actually pretty well with the venetoclax, had a brief dose reduction because of mild neutropenia, but he actually was able to go back on the full dose without issue. However, his insurance plan changed and he kind of just stopped taking venetoclax because he couldn't afford the copay. But he did complete most of the planned 24-month course. He got 18 months out of the planned 24-month course. So he did ultimately then relapse probably about 6 months after stopping venetoclax. And he was symptomatic. And over the course of time, as you know, he was referred to me and, you know, we're thinking about what should his next therapy be. His lymph nodes were pretty bulky and his white count actually went up pretty rapidly too. So I ended up, by the time I saw him doing a PET scan, because I was a little worried about Richter's transformation in this heavily relapsed patient, he did have bulky lymph nodes and splenomegaly, but fortunately the highest SUV was 5. Most of the SUVs were like 3 to 4 range. So I did then think Richter's is, you know, much less likely. I sent repeat prognostic testing. And so he did have trisomy 12, deletion 13Q, and then this deletion of 10Q, so a complex karyotype 3 abnormalities. The FISH showed the 12 and the 13 as well. The molecular test showed a Notch 1 mutation. These are known to be commonly occurring with the trisomy 12. It was a low variant, a low frequency. And he also did have the BTK resistance mutation that did show he had the C481S. It was actually at a very low level, though, which, you know, maybe is related to the fact that then was his last therapy, not the ibrutinib, which was several years ago. So we talked about options. This is someone that I think, you know, absolutely could have gone on a clinical trial. For logistical reasons and due to distance from traveling to my center, he preferred standard of care. And so we started him on pirtobrutinib, 200 milligrams daily. He has had, I'd say, no appreciable side effects from the drug. The only kind of bump in the road in the time that he's been on this drug is he endorsed this chronic cough to me that he actually said predated starting the ibrutinib. He's, even prior to me meeting him, has undergone this like extensive workup for this cough. He has had unremarkable CT scans. So I was pretty kind of underwhelmed that this cough was anything significant. I thought maybe it would be GERD. But nonetheless, he really advocated for himself, underwent a bronchoscopy. This is about 10 months into treatment. And he had this fungus that I'd never heard of, Alternaria, but apparently this is one that's treated with kind of, the, you know, newer generation azoles. So he did get posaconazole for that, had to get the perto dose reduced due to the drug interaction. It's a strong 3A4 inhibitor. And it actually made this cough that had been present for 2 years better. So that was cool. And he's still in a partial remission, otherwise doing well. I hadn't mentioned, but he does have very low IgG levels. And so he's been on IVIG the whole time that I've known him. And that's how he's doing.
You mentioned the fact there were two big phase 3 trials presented. Of course, the other one was with pirtobrutinib. I'd like to hear your take on that. But just kind of curious what your experience has been in terms of tolerability of pirtobrutinib. About how many people have you treated? And do you think you can see a difference between tolerability of pirtobrutinib compared to the second generation covalent BTKIs?
Yeah. So, you know, without the direct comparisons, this is just my anecdote. I think I've treated maybe about 20 patients with Perto. So a good amount, I'd say a lot on trial, but some standard of care. And it's in my practice by far the best tolerated BTK inhibitor. I have only stopped one patient for intolerance, and it turns out her intolerance ended up being something unrelated that, you know, kind of co-occurred with the Perto, but, you know, kind of tracing back the clinical history pre-existed. So extremely well tolerated. The only side effect that I have seen that's been clinically significant has been neutropenia. Most of the time that's been transient. I don't think I've had any patients with, you know, prolonged severe neutropenia the way that I've occasionally seen with venetoclax. So number one, very well tolerated. Number two, very effective. It obviously leaves, you know, something to be desired as far as the duration of response. And so just to review the Bruin 321 trial, so this followed the phase 1-2 Bruin trial that led to the accelerated approval of pirtobrutinib, where the median PFS was around 19 months for patients who had been pretreated with at least a covalent BTK inhibitor. Accelerated approvals, of course, require confirmatory studies. And so that's what we saw presented by Dr. Jeff Sharman at ASH this year. And so to give an overview of the study design, this was patients who had received at least a prior covalent BTK inhibitor. They were randomized to receive either Perto or an investigator choice regimen of Idela, rituximab, or Benda rituximab. I think about 70% of people in the investigator choice got Idela R, and maybe around 30 got BR. You know, of course, I would have loved to see it compared against venetoclax, but, you know, often we don't get the trial we want. So this is the trial we got. I think because of the study design, you know, most patients, the majority of patients had prior venetoclax, but it was about a little over 50%. So it was a global study. I'd say a lot of the patients accrued may not have had access to venetoclax, but there are also these patients who just aren't appropriate for venetoclax for whatever reason. So I think that is just, you know, something to comment upon. The stratification was based on whether they had or hadn't had prior ven, and then based on 17p as well. And it was a positive study, so Pirto did lead to superior progression-free survival. The PFS was a little shorter than what was seen with Bruin. It was around 14 months compared to Bruin's 19 months. But I think a point of emphasis is how high-risk this patient population was. And so it was necessary to have a prior covalent BTK inhibitor. This is the first phase 3 conducted exclusively in, you know, post-covalent BTK inhibitor patients, so very high-risk. But they also had very high risk with respect to like cytogenetics and molecular markers. And so though they were stratified based on 17p, I think the Pirto arm was a little unlucky in that it got a higher proportion of unmutated IHHV and complex karyotype than the investigator choice. And the number of patients with those very, you know, high risk markers was quite high. I think it was like 90 something percent unmutated and a very high percent complex karyotype. But Pirto was superior. PFS 14 months is the bottom line. But I think the other part of the story is they also looked at time to next treatment as a planned secondary analysis. And when you look at the PFS curve, it's kind of this like, you know, stepwise thing where you see that, hey, some of these progressions were probably picked up on the required imaging. And so both arms had the option of continuing past progression. And so a lot of Pirto patients actually continued past progression to where the time to next treatment looked, you know, maybe quite a bit more impressive than the PFS. It was about 2 years for Pirto and, you know, much, much less for the investigator choice. So I think it is supportive of the use of pirtobrutinib. Does it tell us whether we should use Pirto before venetoclax? No, it does not. But I do think it's, assuming we'd see an FDA approval for the second line setting, which I think we probably will, I think it's now another option that we can discuss with patients. And it certainly supports its use in patients in, you know, much later lines of therapy, such as my patient case, which is where I was already using it based on the accelerated approval.
So final question, and patients are eligible for both who are resistant or progressed with BTK and venetoclax. What comes first, pirtobrutinib or CAR-T?
I am a Pirto fan. I think the CAR-T data is not what I hoped for, but it doesn't mean that I would never consider CAR-T. I just think it'll be in the minority of my patients. So I have discussed Lysocell with a few patients. I will say neither took me up on the offer to kind of go forward with, you know, because the response data are just a lot lower than what we've seen with the other malignancies where CAR-T has been so effective. Lysocell is a monotherapy. It's about a 20% CR rate. And that's the most exciting aspect of the data is that the patients who are lucky enough to get that CR, 1 in 5, they can have really long responses. And so I do think that's a unique aspect of Lysocell that's very exciting. I think the downside is it's the minority of patients. The other downside is it's, you know, quite toxic. High rates of CRS, neurologic events, and then a lot of prolonged cytopenias can occur as well. But, you know, the patients I've discussed it with are, you know, young, fit. But in the end, they've said, hey, I'd rather have a drug with a high response rate and I'll, you know, take my chances later because they do know we have a lot of other promising therapies on the horizon. I'd say the BTK degraders are really exciting in trials, you know, bispecifics, et cetera.
Have you seen patients who clearly progressed on a prior BTK who responded to pirtobrutinib as was shown in the trial, but have you actually seen it?
Oh, like dozens of times. Yeah, it's very, very high response rate, and I've seen that a lot in my practice.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Coombs, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.